This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Author Taylor Brandt spent 24 years of his professional life writing the story of Martin Luther King's rise to lead the civil rights movement. The three books are collectively known as America in the King Years, the first of them, Parting the Waters, won the Pulitzer Prize. But those books come in at a shelf-breaking 2,300 pages, not exactly beach reading even for the most ardent bibliophile. So Branch has condensed and highlighted some of the more significant stories in the trilogy. The result is his new book, The King Years, Historic Moments in the Civil Rights Movement. Taylor Branch is an author and, we might add, graduate of UNC Chapel Hill, also the winner of a MacArthur Genius Grant and a National Humanities Medal. And he joins us now from the studios of WYPR in Baltimore. Taylor Branch, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you, Frank, and I'm glad to be back in North Carolina, even over the air.
Well, it's good to have you here. So tell us about this decision now to winnow down 2,300 pages to a 200-page book that summarizes and condenses. Was this your decision?
Well, ultimately it was, but I can assure you it wasn't my idea. I'm vain like most writers, and I had a hard time thinking that I could part with any of the material that took me so long to detail. It was all important to me. But I did get so many complaints over the years from history teachers and, quite frankly, from ordinary readers who fussed about, you know, injured collarbones and everything from holding my books. But more importantly, from teachers who said that they valued the storytelling approach because that was a way to engage students, but that it was impractical even before the digital age to think that college students, let alone high school students, could handle or should be assigned 800-page books. So I finally thought about it more and more, and I took a tour of talking to American history teachers, and their beleaguered state on many fronts convinced me that it was really worthwhile to try to take out the more salient stories here and put them together in a way that would concentrate the lessons from the civil rights movement, because I think that they are so pertinent still today for our future, not just our past.
Yeah, well, they certainly are. How did you do it, though? How did you decide what stays and what goes?
Well, a lot of anguish. It reminded, you know, I had to cut out 700 pages of the manuscript for Parting the Waters in 3 weeks' time, which is still one of my professional nightmares. I got hives. It was very difficult. And the first trip through the manuscript, I realized that I had only cut 3 pages. I had 697 to go. And I did the same thing this time, but you eventually have to develop, I don't know, what some form of bloodlust in thinking that the more you cut out, the more clearly, by contrast, the remaining material will be for your readers, what you decide to keep. It's kind of the difference between painting and sculpture. With sculpture, you're taking away to reveal what's left. And in this sense, I had no goal going in and as to exactly how many episodes I would have or exactly what the pages might be. And believe it or not, it was a surprise to me that it was only 18 in the end and that it came in at less than 200 pages, which shocks me, quite frankly, and probably will shock some of my readers, too.
Well, it does. Now, I will confess to you, I did read all of Parting the Waters and all of Pillar of Fire and then got partway through Volume 3. All right, so that's it. But in those two volumes, every word is a gem, Taylor. Every, you know, and here's the thing. I just wonder about this, because what is exquisite about the trilogy itself is the fact that there is so much context, so much groundwork in understanding the complexities, the history of a movement that certainly did not begin with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., but the history of the black churches. And all of that context is what made, for me and many readers, every word a gem. So I'm wondering if what you had to say to yourself is, look, these stories are important. These crucial moments in the movement for students, particularly high school students, need to be read and understood. Maybe some of the context has to go. How did you do it?
Well, for one thing, I did tell myself, Frank, those other books are not going anywhere.
Right.
At least I hope they're not going anywhere. I tell myself every day that I'm blessed that the books are still in print. Most books go out of print in the first 6 months. The Parting the Waters is more than 25 years old and is still in print. And I hope it will stay so. And I also hope that maybe this new book will stimulate some interest in it. It is still storytelling. The art of this was to pick the stories and stitch them together in the storytelling language. And then in many respects, the hard part was writing each introduction that summarized all the material that was left out in a page or two and dropped you in context into it. Yeah. I believe we learn in cross-racial history by stories that are human, because most of race in America and in human nature is subliminal and subconscious. And so when you bring it up into abstractions and labels and generalities, I think we really fool ourselves to think we're discovering anything and that things have to be personal. But this book is still personal. I'm just trying to pick out the ones that I think are most pertinent to today and the best doorway into this resonant history.
Well, for instance, you include the formation of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, Not Bloody Sunday event in Selma.
Exactly. Well, some of this is a matter of craft. The Bloody Sunday is very detailed, very long, hard to summarize, hard to put in the proportions of this book. And then when I was thinking about it, I realized that the middle march, there were three attempts to have the Selma to Montgomery march. The one that is largely forgotten is the middle one, where they turned around less than only 48 hours after Bloody Sunday. 800 people, mostly religious people, had answered Dr. King's call, which is remarkable in itself. They didn't say we'll have a petition or go to a meeting in 6 months. They were ready in 48 hours with no advance notice. They showed up and were ready to march and risk being beaten again on the bridge. But by that time, Dr. King faced a host of cross-cutting currents. There was an order from a federal judge not to march until he could review the safety procedures. There were pleas from the President of the United States. There were threats from the governor of Alabama. There were all kind of tensions within the movement. And I thought that turnaround march would really highlight to today's readers, if they could see it from the points of view of all the people involved, that really fundamental choices about democracy involved a lot of competing choices about what's important to keep a movement alive, to keep the hope of a political landmark, in this case the Voting Rights Act, alive. And so it was really a great lesson in the crucible of democracy in that one forgotten march.
Mm, exactly. I mean, that's the beauty of the trilogy and what you managed to, in my opinion, maintain in the new book, The King Years, Historic Moments in the Civil Rights Movement, that complexity and all of the competing tensions both within and without that ended up in what we call, these civil rights victories. Let's tell us some of the story a little bit. Let's start with the Montgomery bus boycott in 1955. Martin Luther King, 26 years old. He's new in town. He is reluctant. He really doesn't want to be there. Rosa Parks is arrested in December. Won't give up her seat. We know the story. Protests and boycotts follow. Martin Luther King gives a talk. Let's listen. I want to talk about who this 26-year-old was, who is this pastor who finds himself now about to lead a movement. Let's listen.
Mrs. Rosa Parks was arrested and taken down to jail, taken from the bus, just because she refused to give up her seat. At present, we are in the midst of a protest, the Negro citizens of Montgomery, representing some 44% of the population. 90% at least of the regular Negro bus passengers are staying off the buses, and we plan to continue until something is done.
Martin Luther King, 1955, sounding a little less confident than we will a voice than we will hear in later years. Tell us about him. How he comes to Montgomery in the first place, and who he was when he was 26.
Well, he was a very precocious young student from a relatively privileged background in Atlanta. He was an ardent student of oratory who had doubts about preaching as a career, in part because he was embarrassed a little by his father, who was a holy roller and used to entertain his congregations by shouting and hooping, which was the term of art in the black church. And he was very proud of his brick house and his Cadillac. And Dr. King was not sure about becoming a preacher, but he studied a great deal, and he knew he had a gift for oratory. But he was not looking for a political role. And when this bus boycott occurred, he showed up at a meeting and was drafted to give a speech. And this chapter basically starts with him coming home and telling his wife he won't have time for dinner, and he doesn't have time to prepare a speech. And this protest has started, and it follows him through in front of an audience, most of whom were strangers. He'd only been in Montgomery a year. He didn't know most people. There were thousands of people who turned up. And you see him groping to make a connection with them. He was a more intellectual pastor than a lot of the plain folk who showed up. But he groped until finally in the oratory, in the classic give and take, this chapter shows him establish a relationship with the audience that spans the issue of equal souls and equal votes. He says, if we are wrong, God Almighty is wrong. If we are wrong, the Supreme Court of this nation is wrong. And there was just this thunderous response that came back so much that it seemed to frighten him, and he backed off. And so the relationship with this audience here really is the stirring of a movement. A movement starts, every movement starts when someone is moved, literally in a small way by conscience, and it grows, not naturally, but it grows by tremendous effort and persistence from then on. So this was the stirring of the movement, and it began really in the relationship between him and his audience at a time when he was reluctant and they were all afraid.
Right, movement, not least in Martin Luther King himself, and this theme of making the road by walking, learning as he goes, is one that threads its way throughout the book. Taylor Branch will continue our conversation. The new book, The King Years, Historic Moments in the Civil Rights Movement. Conversation with Taylor Branch continues on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Author Taylor Branch joins us this hour to talk about his new book, The King Years, Historic Moments in the Civil Rights Movement. The book is a condensed version of his multiple award-winning trilogy that includes Parting the Waters, Pillar of Fire, and At Canaan's Edge. The trilogy chronicles the rise of Martin Luther King Jr. during the years 1954 to his death in 1968. So let's go now, Taylor Branch, to 1960. The sit-in movement is underway, not a new concept, but early in 1960, February 1st in Greensboro, there's a sit-in. Is this different and why?
Oh, it's very much different. It's one of the chapters that I chose to put in the condensed book, too. Even though it's called The King Years, there are probably at least a third of these chapters are not, strictly speaking, focused on Dr. King, and this is one of them, because he was the first to admit that there were times when he was not the leader of the movement. He was just always around it, and he was a spokesperson for it, and people were petitioning him. What made Dr. King unusual was that he was the only adult civil rights leader at the time who instantly recognized the sit-ins as a breakthrough. Most people at the time discounted the sit-ins or didn't pay much attention to them, because the idea of young people, young college students, young black college students being significant political leaders was pretty foreign. And in fact, the first sit-ins were treated more like a panty raid or something that need be ignored. King instead said, from his own personal experience, he had been so frustrated trying to, as it were, preach America out of segregation in the 4 or 5 years since the bus boycott, and he failed. He collaborated with Billy Graham. He traveled. He spoke. He said people cried in every audience, and yet you'd wake up the next morning and segregation was still there. He knew that there's some aspects of human nature that are so stubborn that oratory, the best oratory, is not enough, and you've got to figure out ways to make witness. You've got to sacrifice. And that's what these students did. And he instantly recognized that by putting themselves in harm's way and risking their futures, because many of them were the first of their families to go to college, that these sit-in students were taking enormous risks to go to jail, and that they were finding a way to dramatize their cause that would break through people's emotional barriers on the race issue. So the sit-ins were enormously significant, and Dr. King was unusual in the sense that he instantly paid tribute to these students, saying, you are taking your place among the political leaders in the history of American democracy, right up to and including the founding fathers, because he saw them as a leader not just for black people, but for American democracy. And that made him very, very unusual.
And implicit in this, of course, is the fact that movements have multiple forms of leadership and multiple forms of action. And so we find also forming right here in North Carolina the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, at Shaw University in Raleigh, which is going to offer a competing theory about how this movement should be led and run. Tell us about King's involvement in SNCC and the development of SNCC.
Well, there's a lot of mythology and still some controversy about the nature of the relationship between King and SNCC. He paid for all the students who to gather at Shaw University there in Raleigh in April 1960. Remember, this is only 10 weeks after the first sit-in, but by then the sit-ins had spread like lightning through all the southern states, and mostly off of historically black campuses. And the student committees wanted to get together, and Dr. King provided the funds and brought people together there. Some people say that there was a lot of conflict and that he wanted them to be like his student wing. Others say that it was more cooperative at the beginning and that the conflict developed later. But it certainly was a different form of leadership. The students pioneered kind of collective grassroots leadership, whereas Dr. King represented more traditional oratorical follow-me leadership, with the trained orator pointing the way. Later, Bob Moses, who was not there at Raleigh, but later became kind of a seminal figure in SNCC and the instigator of Freedom Summer, he was a Northern Harvard graduate student, grew up black in New York, who came south and really epitomized the SNCC tradition. He was philosophical. He wanted to follow the people and do what they wanted to do, and he became legendary within SNCC as one of many, but a polar leadership style. And one thing about movements, you're always in internal conflict, and you're always struggling for the next move, not really knowing, and therefore multiple leadership styles are a great strength.
And I think probably this all comes together, you might disagree, but in the campaign in Albany, where you have King needs to stay in jail, the white folks want to get him out of jail, the Kennedy administration wants him out of jail, but for a different reason, and SNCC realizes that even if they want this diffuse form of leadership and grassroots kind of movement, they really can't organize people and bring people together without a charismatic leader like King. And many of these elements were seen right in the Albany campaign, am I right?
Right there. And for Dr. King, also the frustration that in Albany, as in many of the early movements in the years 1960 through 62, he was always called in when a movement got in trouble. And that certainly happened in Albany. And the SNCC leader said, well, we may have a different style than him, and we may feel abused because he gets all the credit, but we need to bring him here because he can rally the people and we're in trouble. But he called himself always a fireman, meaning that he was called in to put out other people's fires. And it led to one of the real tipping points in American history, I think. After it took 23,000 U.S. soldiers to guarantee the admission of James Meredith to Ole Miss as the first black student at the end of 1962, that was a very sobering moment for Dr. King. And he said, it's been 8 years since the Brown decision. We're losing our window in history. I've got to take more risk. He'd resisted the sit-ins. He didn't go on the freedom rides. He understood what was going on and was a great spokesperson and leader, but he hadn't subjected himself to a lot of risk, and he resolved as soon as Ole Miss was over that he was going to go into Birmingham and go for broke. And he did that exactly 50 years ago this month, 50 years ago in January 1963, and we are coming up on a long series of 50-year anniversaries beginning with Birmingham and the March on Washington that will be coming up between now and the next 5 years, 50-year anniversaries for the seminal moments in the civil rights era.
Well, that Birmingham campaign in 63, certainly critical to the movement. Talk about some of the conflicts, though, the difficulty in making that decision. And I guess in this case, the role of the national and, in fact, international media by now, by 1963, in making that campaign work and in King's plan.
Well, his plan was to have a well-trained cadre of people, adults again, who were willing to face Bull Connor's jail, Bull Connor, the fearsome and legendary police commissioner in Birmingham, and that it would grow and seize national attention in a way that would force the country to address the issue of segregation, which was, by that time, an awful lot of people thought it was wrong, but it was also fearful, and everybody said it was somebody else's job to do something about it. The missed history, or what was a surprise to me to discover, is that his plan did not work. It fizzled. He wrote the letter from Birmingham jail in April once he decided that he himself had to go to jail there again, and nobody paid any attention to it. And there was no attention either by most of the mainstream media. I mean, Time magazine, the New York Times said it was an ill-timed protest and he shouldn't do it, and basically gave it very little coverage. And the Kennedy administration never mentioned it once. So it was a failure, and he was on the brink of having to withdraw from Birmingham when there began to be pressure from within his staff. Let's don't withdraw until we try to make use of some of the reserve manpower we have in the form of teenagers. And that set off an enormous hidden conflict within Black Montgomery, because most of the adults by then were upset with Dr. King. They said, you came in here promising that you were going to end segregation, and instead a lot of us have gone to jail. There's been people have been fired. There's great tension between the races. It looks like you're going to fail, and now you want to put our high school students in jail and ruin their futures too on your way out of town. And you can imagine there was a ferocious conflict. And some of Dr. King's aides by that time got up into their faces and said, yes, these children have a right to march because you didn't do what you should have done to free them 20 years ago.
And Dr. King himself was concerned about this and putting teenagers
absolutely.
In harm's way.
Absolutely. His host family told him he had to leave because they were afraid. I mean, these were dear friends of his, that they valued him and they loved him, but they were afraid of his influence over their children. So it was personal and it was political, but in the end he threw caution to the wind, and in his great the greatest gamble really of his career, on May 2nd, 1963, they did allow young children to march, and that's what led to the famous scenes of dogs and fire hoses being loosed on the children because they refused to back down. Birmingham thought they would just run away when they were confronted. These are little kids. And instead, they kept singing and marching, and so they loosed dogs and fire hoses on them. And younger and younger children, down to 6 and 8 years old, mostly girls, were this cadre. And that's really what broke through. That's really what seized the attention. Those images, those news photographs became headlines all around the world. And even though the written, printed headlines didn't surprisingly analyze the fact that it was children, the photographs did. People couldn't bring themselves to talk about the fact that this was children, but the photographs made it clear and had an enormous effect and broke down people's emotional distance. And that's really what the tipping point was, and it was only after that, a month later, that people discovered the letter from Birmingham jail, and because Birmingham was so important then it was published. It makes sense that there's misconception about what the sequencing in history was,
right.
But it was those children and the emotional response to the children around the world that made Birmingham a success, that made the letter from Birmingham jail a historic document, and that set the United States on a new course in race relations.
Well, and that global aspect is interesting as well. I mean, you point out that the Soviet Union now is talking more about Birmingham than anything else, and of course we're in this geopolitical struggle for hearts and minds, and racism and segregation don't make us look good when we're talking to the world about freedom.
Exactly. The Cold War cut both ways through this period. It helped the movement in the sense that it facilitated the argument to the Kennedy administration and later the Johnson administration that we can't say we represent freedom in the world if we don't treat our own minorities fairly. On the other hand, there were an awful lot of people who said, if you're concerned about race relations, you're in cahoots with our foreign enemies. You're a subversive. You are undermining us in our free world battle with communism. So it cut kind of both ways. After all, we're coming right out of the McCarthy era and a time of great fear about the threat of communism, even in the United States.
So big cities, the cities Selma, Birmingham, Montgomery, Atlanta, all play a big part in the geography of the civil rights movement. But Durham and Chapel Hill also played a role, and Dr. King spent time in Durham, and it was a comfortable place because there was a black middle class. Tell us about the role of Durham and this area in the state of North Carolina.
Well, they didn't become, neither one of them became like a celebrated place the way Mississippi would be or Birmingham or Memphis or even Albany. But every city that had any sizable minority population had demonstrations in that period. That's what I meant by Dr. King's fireman period. He had to go everywhere. There were demonstrations in downtown Durham. There were demonstrations at Chapel Hill. It's not been too many years ago that the UNC Alumni Magazine published a whole special issue on the demonstrations, the sit-ins in Chapel Hill in 1962 and 1963. And it was a very, very brave, far, I've never seen anything like it in an alumni magazine, which usually is reserved for sunny stories about wonderful events, because even the liberal administration at the University of North Carolina did its best not to pay any attention to those demonstrations, and the people who went through them suffered greatly without a whole lot of notice. So these things were happening in Durham and in Chapel Hill then, even before the Freedom Riders in 1947, the Freedom Riders in 1961, both came through that region on their way south.
So we talked about King. We heard the tape, 1955. Here's a man just finding his voice as he's becoming the leader of a movement. We learn about Birmingham when his whole movement, the leadership is worrying that he's lost his juice. This guy might not be as influential as he once was. He then finds that voice again, the March on Washington later in 1963, August 28th. Here we hear Dr. Martin Luther King. But this is a much different voice than we heard in 1955.
When we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last.
So I'm talking to Taylor Branch today, whose new book is The King Years, Historic Moments in the Civil Rights Movement, a distillation of his trilogy of Martin Luther King and the Civil Rights Movement. The conflicts haven't changed. In fact, it's going to get even more difficult as time goes on. The questions about his leadership haven't changed, and yet he's a much more confident man. Where is he in his mind and heart by this time?
Well, he knows that they're on a national breakthrough out of Birmingham, which spawned demonstrations in over 700 cities in response to those photographs and news footage I mentioned of the dogs and fire hoses on children. So he called the March on Washington in consultation with his friend A. Philip Randolph. So he knew that the movement had moved into a new national phase. And President Kennedy, confronting all of these demonstrations, proposed a civil rights bill in June, the very night that Medgar Evers was murdered coming home from listening to that speech, murdered down in Mississippi. So it was the race issue had seized national front and center. Even Bridge columnists were writing, food people were writing about race. It had come center stage after many, many attempts not to deal with it because it was fearful. And the speech at the March on Washington was a speech kind of setting an agenda for a country and grounding the movement to end segregation in the heart of American patriotism. But Dr. King knew, and anybody involved in the movement knew ever since the bus boycott, that whenever something hopeful happened, not to be too naive and not to put too naive a gloss on the difficulties of race relations. And therefore, it was a shock in nature, but not in kind, that only 3 weeks later there was the terrible Birmingham church bombing in which four little girls were killed preparing to host the Youth Day service. They were in the basement of the 16th Street Baptist Church, out of which the kids had marched that spring. So the Klan attackers picked the church from which the marches were launched, set a bomb. I don't think they intentionally targeted children, but they targeted the whole church, and anybody was in it, and the people who were killed were children. So it showed once again, just like the Emmett Till murder back in 1955 came after the hopeful Brown decision outlawing segregation, that race relation was then and always and had been and still was an issue where there could be great arid pronouncements and hopeful pronouncements, but there was another reality lurking nearby, and that was the church bombing that followed soon after.
I'm talking with Taylor Branch. His new book, The King Years, Historic Moments in the Civil Rights Movement. Our conversation will continue in a moment. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio. We're talking today with author Taylor Branch. His new book, The King Years, Historic Moments in the Civil Rights Movement. He's previously chronicled MLK in a trilogy collectively known as America in the King Years. Those books were titled Parting the Waters, Pillar of Fire, and At Canaan's Edge. He's won the Pulitzer Prize. And now we're talking about this new 200-page distillation and also going back over the remarkable civil rights movement. The focus of the movement, of course, at the beginning is to end segregation in the South. It takes a lot of turns and a crucial decision on the part of Dr. King by 1967 to see the Vietnam War as part of the structure and part and all of a piece when it comes to social justice in America. Let's listen.
So we have been repeatedly faced with the cruel irony. Watching Negro and white boys on TV screens as they kill and die together for a nation that has been unable to seat them together in the same schools. So we watch them in brutal solidarity, burning the huts of a poor village, but we realize that they would hardly live on the same block in Chicago. I cannot be silent in the face of such cruel manipulation of the poor.
Dr. Martin Luther King in 1967, Taylor Branch, talk about the decision to add the Vietnam War, to protest the Vietnam War.
Well, from 1964 on, from the time he won the Nobel Prize, Dr. King's career took a sharp turn. Instead of trying to become upward and deal with segregation, he became more prophetic and lonely. He said he went first to Selma when everybody wanted to celebrate the Civil Rights Act of 64 for about 20 years. He said, no, the valley calls me to Selma. Then he went north to show that the race issue was not and never had been purely sectional in the South. And then, as you say, he took on Vietnam because he had to basically keep faith with what he had announced at the Nobel Prize ceremony, that the nonviolent movement was not purely about racism and about race. It was about the larger issues of violence, war, and poverty, what he called racism, war, and poverty. He called them violence of the flesh and violence of the spirit, and that nonviolence had set loose the widest liberation in human history, and that he wanted to bear witness for it. And part of that was bearing witness again against the advice of all his advisors in Vietnam. And finally, down at the end of his life, largely ignored by that part, or certainly certainly not as center stage as he had been earlier among the sanitation workers in Memphis. So this was a whole different phase of Dr. King's career after letting loose these tides of freedom that I think in many respects are still washing up to our benefit today, that once the race issue has always been the doorway to understanding what the Democratic promise means. It's where most of the resistance is, but it's also where the breakthroughs are. And when Dr. King and that movement, after 10 years, got America finally to focus on what we meant by equal citizenship, equal souls, and equal votes, it set loose benefits not just for black people, but of course for the white South, which is what he said, that once it ended segregation, it would become liberated psychologically, economically, no longer stigmatized in politics, fit, as I often joke, for professional sports, which didn't even exist down there when it was segregated, but also then for the disabled, for women. Who couldn't go to most – they couldn't go to Chapel Hill when I was there. Only 5% of the student body was women by state law. And when the civil rights movement got people to confront race and the subjugation of race, it set loose an awful lot of liberation for other people. So that I try to argue that this movement is about the future, not about the past. And if you're the parent of a daughter – who wants to go to Chapel Hill or to Princeton or West Point. I mean, the idea that women could go to West Point, white women or black women, was so foreign back then, and now we take it for granted, and that they can be rabbis for the first time in 2,000 years of rabbinic Judaism. All this is because people began to struggle with the civil rights movement, and so I tried to put out this book, Frank, quite frankly, because race has been kind of the barometer of our democratic practice. It's been the measure of our breakthroughs from the Civil War on, but it's also been something that has we have deceived ourselves and mythologized. We misremembered the Civil War for 100 years, so that when I was growing up, I was taught that the Civil War had nothing to do with slavery in Atlanta and that the slaves were better off here than that they had been in Africa. And my textbooks literally said, and some still do, that the people who restored white supremacy to the South and paved the way for segregation after the Civil War were called redeemers. That's a religious word. When in fact it was the Klan and Klan terror. So the subconscious avoidance of race and impact of race can cause us to misremember our history and cause problems for ourselves. And I hope that this book will begin to put our own history more in balance, because I think for the last 50 years we have misremembered the civil rights movement, which has set loose a lot of liberations and things that we value. But it also set loose a misremembering and a resentment and a fear in the idea that government is bad and that it has distorted our politics and paralyzed it, and that race itself is responsible for a lot of our gridlock and our misremembered history, and that only now perhaps these 50-year anniversaries coming forward can help us get back into balance again.
Well, and as you suggest, part of the misremembering is a sense that this was only about race, but Dr. King certainly brought it into other areas. And yet, as you say, he got much more lonely as the years went on when he tried to make these connections between violence, American imperial violence abroad, economic injustice here in the United States, and how black and white together were suffering under the same system. He became more and more lonely and found himself with fewer and fewer followers, and perhaps was at his most dangerous, because he was threatening not a sectional system of socialization, but in fact a whole national order, would you say?
Yes. Yes, as he got more lonely, he always had a prophetic message, but as he got more lonely and he risked more and took on other issues, his beliefs didn't change. It was how much he chose to risk, and he risked basically being marginalized by taking on these prophetic issues. And if you look at it, and he was abandoned not just by people who opposed him on the race issue, but he was abandoned also by many people on the left, people who supported civil rights, turned against him, turned against nonviolence. Nonviolence is arguably the most powerful notion that and tactic that came out of the civil rights movement, but it was also the first to become passé, and it's not it was understandably attacked. It's difficult. A lot of people said, black people said to Dr. King, why is it that Americans admire nonviolence only in black folks, but otherwise they admire John Wayne and James Bond? It's not fair that people who are victims have to further victimize themselves by accepting nonviolence. And what Dr. King would say is, you're absolutely right, it's not fair, but nonviolence is a leadership discipline to show people that democratic strength and strength in a democracy is the ties that we make with one another across the lines that divide us. That's what a vote is. That's what democracy is. And that it's a leadership tactic. And if we abandon nonviolence to become more like white people, we're going backwards, not forwards, to be just like white people. And in that sense, he was speaking what I think is the historically accurate view, which was that the African-led, American-led movement of that era was leaders not just for black people about quaint issues like where you sat on a bus, but it was a leader for the whole country about, you know, how seriously we make our democracy and what benefits we get when we do reach to each other across the lines that divide us.
He said it. He lived it. He died because of it. Do we remember him because of it? And has that word, has that idea, as you say, it was nonviolence, the most effective strategy in the 20th century. I mean, the Raj in India, the civil rights movement, Jim Crow here, totalitarian communism in the Soviet bloc, and arguably apartheid, though violence was associated with all of them. Yeah, the most successful ever. And yet, has the idea died with King, do you think?
I don't think so. I think it's there. I think it's like so many things on race, that there's subliminal truths and messages that get buried and they're still there. That's why I have so much hope that maybe 50 years from now is a period where we can get more balance. We've been imprisoned by and large by 50 years of fear and resentment of this time, and we're coming out of it. The way I like to think of that is it's only 50 years ago this month that George Wallace pledged segregation now, segregation forever. And he failed in that message. But in retreat, George Wallace invented most of the really compelling phrases that have dominated politics. And he denounced pointy-headed bureaucrats for telling us how to run our businesses and where we can go to school, in cahoots with a biased liberal media that was trying to concentrate all effective power in the central government, big government in Washington. Those are all George Wallace phrases. They were in resentment against race, but they have poisoned us against the promise of our own national politics in many respects in a dead end. And it's kind of reached the end of the road, and I'm hoping maybe we can regain some balance and along with it some optimism, not naive optimism, because it seems to me that the lesson of Dr. King, you can hear it in his voice, is that hope is not enough. You've got to be realistic and you've got to be tenacious. But if you really cling to the promise of American democracy in the long run, you can make really good things happen.
Do you worry that we have domesticated the memory of Dr. King? We don't remember him for the dangerous and provocative character that he was, and that in domesticating him, he's become a far weaker influence on us than he should be?
Well, that's certainly, to some degree, that's true of every historical icon, you know, George Washington chopping down the cherry tree and that sort of thing. But I think it's particularly true in Dr. King's case that an awful lot of people want to think of him as something about things that no longer apply, that are about people sitting on the back of the bus and pat him on the head for dealing with a problem that doesn't really affect us today or affect our future. When, in fact, I think Lyndon Johnson's one of the few people who recognized publicly that the civil rights movement was not only from the heart of American patriotism, but that it was actually a leadership form for us, and it's about where we're going. And until all of America sees Dr. King and that movement as leadership for the health of a democracy's future and not just a quaint part of its past, we won't. We'll still be not realizing the potential and, as you say, domesticating him at our own peril.
And it is interesting, and I wonder what you make of this, the fact that your trilogy is still in print and that there is interest in this new book, which consolidates it. I guess there lies some of the hope. There is still great interest in this movement, understanding it in its detail, all of its challenges and complexity.
Yes. So I think basically the reason I did this book is kind of an experiment for me to try to make these this turning point in history and this rebalancing possible. But it comes at a time not only when history seems to be possibly changing course, but when the way we learn is too. And so this is a new book, a condensed book. It's out in an enhanced ebook that I can't even read because I don't have an iPad. And I'm trying to teach a course built around it that is experimental. We have auditors as part of the revolution in education that are not only high school teachers all over the United States, but we have people in Russia and the Solomon Islands who are tuning in online, and I'm utterly baffled by the technology. But, you know, there are hopeful things that, you know, we can use the technology to get around the barriers that have prevented understanding of this. And so if this works out, I will keep teaching this course using this this compact book as a text and try to open it up for people who are interested in the message, because I think the message is timeless. It's just our appreciation for it and the technology by which we share it that is changing so rapidly.
You know, you devoted nearly a quarter of a century to putting this book together and gathering the details, so perhaps this is unlikely, but when you went back over it, was there anything about this movement, anything about what you had collected that surprised you or that you sort of didn't remember that way as you went back over the book to come up with a new one?
Well, it was like reliving the movement to go back through it. Quite frankly, I'd forgotten a lot of the detail from some of it that was so long ago. But every time I do think personal stories, it's kind of like lyrics in music. You know, you have a vast amount of lyrics in your head that you couldn't get out if you tried from the songs of your childhood. And that's the way I was about these details. I would come across it, and it would re-trigger how I learned it and the cornfield where I interviewed the sharecropper in Mississippi. It would come back to me. And in that sense, it's still treasured. You know, I'm a white Southerner who wasn't interested in politics, but the movement changed the direction of my interests against my will, so I wanted to know where it came from, and I don't regret a moment of it, because every time I go back through those details, I get goosebumps.
Taylor Branch, always so grateful for reluctant prophets like you. Thank you so much. Honored to talk with you.
Thank you, Frank.
Taylor Branch, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of the trilogy America in the King Years. The new book, The King Years, Historic Moments in the Civil Rights Movement. He joined us from the studios of WYRP in Baltimore. Thank you for listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.